Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The next matter on the calendar this morning is the Jonathan Association and S3 Holdings LLC versus Chase Worth. Counsel for the appellant may proceed when ready, and when both counsel reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us. Thank you.
Kelly Griffiths, Your Honor, GRIFFITTS for the appellant.
Oh, that's all right. You can go ahead.
When I get to the podium.
And thank you for identifying yourself.
Say if you want to raise the podium, you can, I think.
Yes. You're going to get a strained neck.
Oh, wow.
High tech.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm glad I don't have to operate it.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Your Honors, may it please the court. Mr. Doherty, my name is Kelly Griffiths, and I represent the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, this case involves service by publication under Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure 4.04A, paragraphs 4 and 5 of that rule. Prior to service by publication under the Shamrock case, the appellant needed to establish that one of the five enumerated factors under Rule 404 existed, that they were in fact true, and had to establish by affidavit that the appellant believed respondent was not a resident of the state of Minnesota, and that he had mailed the summons and complaint to respondent's last known address. The two enumerated factors in Minnesota Rule 404 that appellant relied on was that the subject of the action is real property within the state, and the action is seeking to eliminate respondent's interest in the property. And the fifth one, the alternative enumerated factor, is that appellant was foreclosing its association lien. The trial court, however, on page 9 of her order, analyzed this case under the wrong enumerated factor, and that's important. The trial court cited Rule 404A2A, which states that service by publication is sufficient where the plaintiff acquired on a lien on the property by attachment or garnishment, and the defendant is a resident individual who has departed from the state or cannot be found therein. Those are the enumerated factors that have to be true prior to publication of the summons as effective service. And if that were the case, if we were operating under Rule 404A2A, the trial court's analysis would have been correct. Because the enumerated factor that the defendant was a resident individual who departed from the state or cannot be found therein was, in fact, not true. Mr. Worth apparently did actually live at the property address.
Well, counsel, isn't this case more than being about whether or not the affidavit that was filed, which preceded publication, was sufficient? Isn't this case really about what needs to occur once there is a proper challenge to jurisdiction? Isn't that really what the case is about? I'm looking at very old case law in this area, but it's common law. And I don't think there's anything in the rule that suggests that the Supreme Court intended to abrogate common law or that the rule supersedes common law. So when I look at the development of the law, it seems to me, looking at an 1891 case, that the law in this state was actually changed back in 1864. When the Minnesota Supreme Court noted that the legislature adopted a radical change to our law, and at that point in time no longer required that people filing an affidavit for publication set forth all of the due diligence that had been engaged in. But thereafter, when we look at the Supreme Court's decision in WIIIK, W-I-I-K, in n- 1928, we find out that once there's been a proper challenge to jurisdiction after publication based on the rule, then the inquiry does turn to the question of whether or not a diligent search for the party served has occurred. Isn't that really what this case is about?
Whether or not the appellant made a diligent search of the whereabouts of respondent?
Yes.
Yes, and I think the appellant can easily establish that because by respondent's own admission, they found the address where Mr. Worth resided, which was the property in question. The trial court did something more than that, though. It indicated that that you had to prove that you, not that you used due diligence in searching for the respondent, but that you used due diligence in your attempts to serve the respondent. And I think there's an important distinction there.
So you think that the diligence, when I'm looking at, along the lines of Judge Shellhouse's questions in Van Rie, an older case that was based on a statute that's almost verbatim what the rule is now.
That's correct.
The Supreme Court said that the statute means that the proper affidavit, and I understand your argument about the five enumerated factors and the focus being on one instead of the other. So we're really focused on what is required in the affidavit. And the affidavit, according to that, means that the proper affidavit has been made. Unless it can be shown that the plaintiff or his attorney, by the use of ordinary diligence, could have ascertained where the defendant could be found. So you think that the diligence that's required is only diligence to find, not to serve? So if they just knew that he was there but made no effort at serving, that suffices for the affidavit? That seems not it, right.
Yes. I mean, that's what the court in that Van Rie case stated, that the court required a diligent search for the defendant. But of course, if you actually find the defendant, your affidavit that where you state that he's not a resident of the state or cannot be found therein would be false, and you can't move forward on that basis. Not that you would not have a good faith belief that is true. The attorney would not have had a good faith belief if you actually found him.
So what is a good faith belief? What is a good faith belief here that...
That he was not a resident of the
state
or cannot be found therein? There's several factors. There were multiple mailings to this address, which defendant did not respond to. Multiple mailings by the town hall, or the condominium association, Mr. Fuller, one of the previous attorneys, sent multiple mailings and didn't get an answer. Brian Helsher, the attorney prior to me, mailed to the respondent a notice of foreclosure, pre-foreclosure notice, as required by the statute. He actually mailed the summons and complaint to the respondent and didn't get a response. In addition, and none of those mailings came back. In addition, the respondent had a North Dakota telephone number, which would imply to me that I think it's reasonable to assume that a person with a North Dakota telephone number
I have a North Dakota telephone number, and I haven't lived in North Dakota in 68 years, so I disagree with that comment, counsel.
It's not necessarily the case, but most people with the North Dakota telephone number live or reside in North Dakota.
Or on the western side of Minnesota.
Right, but, well.
And there aren't a lot of people in North Dakota, so there may be more in western Minnesota.
Was that a hard line or a cell phone?
There's no way that Mr. Helscher would have known that one way or the other.
People who get cell phone numbers move all over the world and don't change the cell phone number.
They do, Your Honor. I'm just saying it's more likely than not that a person with a North Dakota telephone number lives or resides in North Dakota. I think it's reasonable for him to assume that person lives in North Dakota.
I would beg to differ. I think with cell phones, it's no longer a reasonable assumption.
The other factor I would point to is that he wasn't listed on the condominium complex directory.
The reason they went there is because they thought he lived there. The reason they mailed to that address is because they thought he was there. And you're saying that belief was then dissipated by the fact that he did not respond to them? Therefore, they believed he was no longer there, even though they thought that was his address, and that's why they went there.
That was his last known address. He did, in fact, at one time own that property. And I think you have a certain responsibility, if you do own a property, to, track your mail. And the fact that it wasn't coming back, it could have been forwarded by the U.S. mail to his actual address. But by the skip trace that they had, that was the last known address of respondent.
And in fact, it was his address.
And in fact, it was his address. So he must have got those mailings, which certainly would have satisfied due process under the U.S. Supreme Court case, Mullane, because they advertised and mailed it to him. But I do think it's important as well that the process server went to the condominium complex and he wasn't listed as residing in the property.
Well, why didn't he leave? The process server called the telephone number.
Yes.
But didn't leave a message.
No, he did not.
The process server apparently tried to contact the condominium manager, I think.
Yes.
And wasn't successful and never tried again.
That's correct.
It just doesn't sound diligent to me. It didn't sound diligent to the district court.
Right. But the other thing about the factor that the district court was analyzing this case under was part of the enumerated factor is that they're actually not a resident of the state and they cannot be found therein. I mean, that you have to prove that as a fact. We didn't have to prove that as a fact. We have to prove that the attorney, Mr. Helscher, had a reasonable belief that he wasn't, Mr. Chase was not in the property.
Well, and that's the question. Was it reasonable?
But the district court didn't find that. The district court found that we had to prove as true, as a fact, that he lived in the property. She never addressed whether or not it was reasonable.
So are you asking for a remand to do further fact-finding? On that, is that the problem, that there was just an absence of fact-finding because the wrong test was applied?
I think a remand would be appropriate because the wrong test was applied. She found that, again, that she didn't determine that Mr. Helscher's belief was in bad faith, which I think the standard would be.
What case tells us that there has to be a finding that the belief set forth in the affidavit must have been in bad faith?
It's in the statute that the affiant believes the defendant is not a resident of the state or cannot be found therein.
Well,
we have to take a reasonable person standard, right? And it's not Mr. Helscher's subjective belief. It's his whether or not his belief is reasonable.
But if we do that, and I appreciate that, so it seems like you acknowledge that the affidavit isn't just a subjective belief, regardless of how unreasonable. It has to be a good faith belief based on some diligence to locate the person.
Right.
And the district court did talk about, even if the analysis didn't come at it the right way, the district court did find an absence of satisfaction of the common law requirement of diligence. So doesn't that serve the affidavit issue just as well as the other?
I don't think so. She found that it was whether or not the search was diligent. And I'll point out, before my time's about up, but in Abu Dhabi, or however you say that case, she made no attempt to personally serve the defendant in that case, none whatsoever.
But I thought that you thought that the diligence went to the having whether the person could be found.
And they found that service was, sorry, Your
Honor. Oh, I'm sorry. And the district court here on addendum page 12 said plaintiff did not diligently attempt to locate defendant. I thought that was consistent with your argument that the diligence required is not diligence to serve, but diligence to locate, to find. Maybe I misunderstood your argument earlier.
No, that is my argument, okay, that they're required to search for diligently, but not required to use due diligence and service of the summons and complaint. My time's up. Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Matt Doherty, and I represent the respondent, Chase Wirth. The district court decision upholding our motion to vacate the default judgment must be affirmed for four primary reasons. First, equity requires it. Second, Shamrock and the Minnesota Supreme Court require it. Due process requires it, and standard of review requires it. Let me first get to the equity argument. We're talking about taking away a man's home over a $2,000 association lien.
I think maybe it'd be better, since we're reviewing a district court's decision, not making an equitable decision ourselves, to can you put it in a framework of our standard of review? Are there factual findings we need to defer to?
Absolutely. I'll go straight to that standard of review, and it hasn't been touched on at all. We talked about getting into the mind of, I don't think it was a diligent search. The district court didn't think it was a diligent search. It's not whether you, as a court of appeals, think it was a diligent search or not. It's whether the district court judge abuses discretion as making that determination that it wasn't a diligent search. It's a high standard of review that you do not have the ability to just go out and come up with a contrary decision. This is there's plenty of case law that talk about the standard of review being abuse of discretion.
Isn't our standard of review under Shamrock de novo? A different standard of review with respect to the facts that the district court made in terms of whether or not they're clearly erroneous. But the Shamrock case says whether service of process was effective and personal jurisdiction exists is a question of law that we review de novo.
But there are also, I believe, cited in my brief, plenty of cases that talk about the standard of review on a motion to vacate a default judgment should be abuse of discretion. Within that, I believe there are certain legal determinations that, of course, would be de novo, and factual determinations that would be subject to a clearly erroneous standard of review.
Is that a factual finding by the district court that there was not sufficient diligence to locate? Is that a factual finding that we review for clear error then?
Or clearly erroneous, I believe, yes. I believe that would be a factual determination. And there's also case law that talk about that discretion that's given is even greater when there's conflicting affidavits or affidavits that she has to weigh the testimony of at the district court level. The court reviews gives even greater discretion in those situations. Let me also get into the Shamrock case, which we haven't really talked about too much, but the Shamrock decision changed the game, I think, in some prior court of appeals opinions that even that Abu Dhabi case or had a much easier way of serving by publication. And I think the Shamrock upped it. I think it with that Shamrock case stating that the essential jurisdictional facts must exist, I think that that effectively altered or potentially even reversed some prior Court of Appeals decisions on service by publication. You can also look at the facts. But
do you agree, though? I mean, Shamrock was dealing with one of the five enumerated facts that required that.
Right.
Not talking about, I mean, and so, it was, and what we're talking about here, I guess you would agree, would you not, that we're under four or five?
Sure,
four
and five.
The district court made a mistake in thinking it was under two.
But at the same time, if you read all of 404A, you look down to the very bottom where it talks about cannot be found or not a resident of the state. That cannot be found, that implies the diligence, I think. And I think that jurisdictional facts, the essential jurisdictional facts from Shamrock, it quoted the entire 404A, and it didn't just say, well, it's only applied to 404A1 and not the other factors. It's broad enough, and the language in that Shamrock case is broad enough to apply to any of the factors under 404A.
Well, in Shamrock, the appellant had made an argument with respect to the existence of facts in the affidavit and a due process argument, and the Supreme Court did not address due process. What is your basis for addressing due process in this case?
Well, I think it's an alternative argument. I think maybe the easier response would be to simply say that 404A says that they cannot be found and that Shamrock says the essential jurisdictional facts must exist. Here it's been conceded by counsel that, you know, he is a resident of Minnesota. They knew he was a resident of Minnesota based on their skip trace. They went to his house, his condo unit. They didn't knock on his door. They saw that he had a ground floor unit. There was furniture sitting outside in his patio, and they never actually went and knocked on the window, knocked on the door. They served him around like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Guy works during the day. There was no real service attempts made. It was a complete lack of service attempts.
Well, what about opposing counsel's argument that the diligence requirement pertains only to actually locating the defendant's whereabouts and not to actually serving the defendant? If I understood that correctly.
Well, I would say that I don't know if that's clear in the case law as I review it and I think about it, but that it wouldn't make sense that it's just locating them. The whole point of service of process is to apprise someone of the a case is going on, that we hear cases on the merits so that you know that you're going to be served. Very clearly, Chase did not know that this was going on. He continued to pay his mortgage. He continued to pay his utilities. If he knew that, you know, he couldn't pay this $2,000 debt on association dues, he probably would have just let it go and moved out and gone on. But he completely had no idea what was going on until he got actually served. And here's an interesting point. He was actually served from the eviction notice.
Okay, but what difference does it make if he knew or he didn't, if he was opening his mail or not opening his mail?
I think it makes a little bit of a difference on from an equitable standpoint, because I think you are looking at this from I mean, it seems wrong if in some respects if there was absolutely it, you know, it seems like he's attempting to avoid service at that point, right?
Well, I don't think that allegation has necessarily been made, but is there a, I mean, it's not illegal to avoid service of process.
Sure.
Is it?
No. Not at all.
I don't think that that's an argument that's been made in this case.
No.
That he was.
Right. The arguments is basically we don't have to knock on his door. We don't have to actually, we just have to locate him. We don't have to actually serve him or attempt to serve it.
Well, it's not that we have to locate him. It's that we have to find out that he doesn't, we have to believe in good faith following diligence that he doesn't live here or he can't be found.
Right.
And so if you believe those, let's assume another situation where you actually, I know you disagree on the facts on that, mm-hmm. but let's assume that there are different facts and that you have in good faith diligently tried to locate someone and failed, mm-hmm. and you have other reason, or you have other reason to believe he lives elsewhere. Why would you need to try and serve a place that, following diligence, you believe the person isn't there?
Hmm.
I mean, it's not, it's the opposite of locating. It's actually exactly. finding that he's not there is what the,
At that point, mm-hmm. you're right. I mean, trying to attempt to serve an address that you have no idea where he was is an act of futility. Yeah.
So I think your better argument, though,
sure.
is that the going to the door wasn't sufficient to undermine the other evidence that he lived there or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But not necessarily that there has to be a diligence in serving.
Right, right.
Or
I
attempting
agree.
Attempting service.
I agree with you, Your Honor. Correct. I would also just point out that this Abu Dhabi case is not applicable in the sense that the facts are totally different. If you look at that case, it talks about a Jordanian man who was just an awful person and did terrible things. And I think the courts, Court of Appeals, have looked at these cases with a background to the underlying facts. So they granted service in that case and in under entirely different set of circumstances here because it was a international type case. But they were pretty lax in allowing the service of process in that case to go through, whereas here, you know, we don't have any, you know, there is no bad facts associated with Chase. He, you know, he didn't do wrong that would allow a court to maybe skirt some of the procedural safeguards of due process.
Well, Chapter 518 in the marriage dissolution area requires that a party who wishes to serve by publication get a court order allowing service by publication in advance, and that's noted, really. I mean, you can kind of get a glimpse of that in the parenthetical in appellant's brief.
Sure.
Here, there is no requirement that you get a court order in advance of publishing for service of process in a civil case. You prepare your affidavit, set forth your bases. You must state that there's a belief, which is contained in this affidavit, and it's only then that if there is a proper challenge to jurisdiction that the court actually gets into the facts, the good faith, the due diligence, and so forth. So.
Agreed, Your Honor. That's correct. That kind of blends into this burden of proof standard that was talked about in his brief that I hadn't responded to, but he cites the Peters versus Waters instrument case for the proposition that once a plaintiff submits evidence of service, you know, it's now our burden to establish that the service was improper. If you look at footnote 4 of the Shamrock case, they specifically talk about that case, and it requires first evidence of service. Here there was no evidence of service. Therefore, it's not our burden to establish that service of process was insufficient. It's actually appellant's burden to establish that their attempted service and their service by publication was sufficient. So I think the burden of proof standard is wrong, and if you look at footnote 4 in Shamrock, that will clarify that point. Your Honor, I have nothing further at this time. If you have any more questions, I'm happy to answer them. All right, thank you, Your Honor.
I don't really have anything further. I'll take any questions if you have them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.